Here on the Oval Office, we like to discuss multiple leaders and their different methods to solving world issues related to all kinds of global affairs. Prime Ministers of the United Kingdom are vital players on the political stage in this sense. They're the leading figures who shape British politics and are extremely influential in wider international conflict. We'd like to find out about what makes a good Prime Minister and what attributes, regardless of party, would they need to show or act to do a good job in office. So, to help us answer that deeply interesting question, we're joined by a very special guest, Sir Anthony Selden, one of Britain's leading political historians, whose work is focused on the people at the very centre of power. Sir Anthony, thank you so much for joining us here on the Oval Office.
What a pleasure to be on the Oval Office. Thank you guys for having me.
Brilliant. So, in your extensive years of research in politics, you must have gathered so much knowledge from many different sources, but what we really want to know about is your backgrounds to politics. So could you please give us an insight into where this all started for you and your journey in British politics specifically?
So I sat my A-levels and at a school called Tunbridge, totally inferior to Wellington, obviously, and I did so badly I had to do another lot of A-levels, so I picked politics. No idea what it was. I think it was the only department that would accept me, but I fell in love with it, you know, and I then did it for uni, or part of my uni degree, and I then couldn't decide what to do, and sort of, you know, toss up between really playing for Arsenal, playing for the Harlequins, and or joining a rock band, and you know, those opportunities, you know, I was waiting, I just didn't get the invitations coming forward, so I thought I'd do it. Some research. So that's what you do, doesn't it? If you can't decide quite what to do. So, and they did, unlike those other places, give me a place. And so there I was. I was writing a doctorate and it was about Prime Minister Churchill, who came back as Prime Minister after the war. And, you know, we knew lots about him during the war. We knew much less about him after the war. So that was my doctorate. That was at LSE. And then it became a book called Churchill's Indian Summer. And, you know, once you write your first book, it's much easier to write your second and third. The really hard thing in life is to write, you know, to do anything for the first time. So that was it. So that gave me the bug back in the 1980s into writing about prime ministers.
So I think what we really want to draw into is, in today's world of politics, a lot of people talk about what makes a good prime minister, what makes a bad prime minister, but it ends up always party-based, right? It ends up being, well, you have this view of a good prime minister if you see them at this party or if it's this party. But we kind of wanted to know, does always a good / bad prime minister come from their party?
No. It's like any leader. What makes a great head? What makes a great captain of a team, what makes a great head of a company, head of a charity, anything, you know? I mean, it's the same quality. A leader has to lead. I mean, that sounds obvious, doesn't it? But, you know, a lot of them just don't lead. They don't provide that quality and clarity of leadership and communication. So when it was 2021, 6 years ago, 5 years ago, indeed, it was the 300th anniversary of the British Prime Minister. 1721 was the first. And so I did a series, presented it on BBC, and then I read a book called Impossible Office for Cambridge, which was about the history of the office and who were the good ones, who were the bad ones. And by that stage, there were 55. And I said that there were nine who really stood out. There were nine iconic, historic, great, truly great prime ministers. And there were a second 11 team of people who were 11 who were pretty good, but not great. And then there were three other classes below that. And then there was Liz Truss, so in a separate league of her own. So, you know, you've got to say it makes no difference whether you are Tory, Labour, Liberal. A great leader is a great leader. And to be that, you've got to be you've got to be not just good at the job, but you've got to be a good human being also. So, I mean, that would rule out Donald Trump. Well, he's not prime minister, that's a bit of a rule out, but he would rule him out from being a great president.
And I think an interesting point to go off there is, obviously, you're saying you've almost categorised these prime ministers into, I mean, A tier,
yeah,
those structures. What, when you were forming those different brackets as such, what did you use as your best metric for, I mean...
So thanks, Arthur, and thanks for those questions before, Will. I think that, look, there are lots of party games where, you know, regularly at Christmas, people are asked to list their favourite and their worst prime ministers, and Churchill normally comes out top. Thatcher's pretty close to the top. And at the bottom, well, that's pretty easy too, as mentioned. And Boris Johnson certainly is tried really, really, really hard to be the worst. And which is a tragedy because he could have done so much better, but another story. And so I try and find, rather than just people's preferences, like, you know, list your favourite football teams or your favourite, I don't know, favourite holiday destinations, I tried to make it more scientific. Who had, you know, you had to have left the country in a stronger state than you came into it. You had to have sorted out the economy, left the union stronger. You had to have changed the perception of leadership. You had to change the perception of the office of prime minister. After you left, people carried on talking about you for years afterwards. Either they wanted to be like you, subsequent prime ministers, or unlike you, but none could escape that weather, like Thatcher. I mean, people still talk about Thatcher. And so those are the criteria I had, yeah?
Sure. And then, sorry, just an extension question on that. In terms of, we've obviously talked about personal attributes towards the prime minister. How much weighting do you put towards the actual attributes of the prime minister and then the situation which they're placed within?
Hey, that's another great question. Thank you, Arthur. We always, history is a two-dimensional subject often. I mean, not taught by the brilliant history and politics teachers at Wellington College, but in general, because we tend to just look at what somebody does and not think what their opportunity was. So we tend to think that great leaders create history, whereas a subtler approach is to say that often they were created by history. So if you look at the great history, look at those great nine, they share common characteristics. They were all there at times of really major significance in the world. So world wars, great famines, great danger to the country. It's much easier to shine when you are picking the country up out of a ditch or when the country is under threat. And therefore, you know, it begs the question, do great leaders make history or are great leaders made by history? So looking again at Donald Trump at the moment, you know, we can say, well, Donald Trump is really pushing the Overton windows in all kinds of directions. But we can also say, you know, he's redefined what a president can do. But America, after a prolonged period of disappointment with presidents, a prolonged period of static living standards and a decline in the country globally, were looking for somebody who was going to offer them dreams. And he certainly offered people dreams.
Yeah, I think that's interesting what you said, that political leaders can be made through, say, by history, but also from history, what are you saying?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they can be made. So, I mean, sometimes prime ministers have great historic opportunities. So, I mean, Boris Johnson, for example, the first prime minister after Brexit happened, after Britain left the EU, significantly engineered by him, had the opportunity to really make a difference, a massive difference. And also with Brexit, you know, that was a 1 in 100 year, let's hope, epidemic. So those were enormous opportunities that he had to make a difference to Britain. But he didn't solve Brexit. I mean, how's Britain better off out of Europe? He didn't have that plan, and he clearly didn't. I mean, he did quite well in some ways on COVID, but he has been heavily criticised for a reason. So, and another example of a prime minister who didn't rise to the occasion would be Asquith at the beginning of the First World War, or Neville Chamberlain at the beginning of the Second World War, or Lord North, as he was called, 1770 to 1782, Prime Minister at the time of the American War of Independence, and he was responsible for not solving the American problem, and Britain lost the colonies. Now, sure, the colonies would have left at some point, but maybe if they had kept close to Britain for another 20, 50, 100 years, that might have been mutually beneficial. I mean, it might, for example, have avoided the American Civil War, which was devastating to American life. Yep. Cool. Next one.
I do have another question. Do you think that a prime minister is always set to be made from their environment, the background that they come into? And so basically then, can you see who's going to be an unsuccessful versus who's going to be a successful prime minister? Or
so this is one of the really great questions. Now, you are both what age?
17 and 16.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so the really interesting question is, I mean, if people listening to this and the parents look back at people they knew at school, they're pretty much the same people that they were when they were 16 and 17. I mean, you know, we are pretty recognisable. And that would lead one to think that somebody coming into the office of Prime Minister isn't really going to change very much. So Keir Starmer is pretty much what Keir Starmer promised he was going to be. But the most successful ones do learn on the job. You can learn and get better at it, because nothing prepares you for being a prime minister. You might have been Minister of Defence, you might have been Home Secretary, you might have been Foreign Secretary, you might have been Chancellor of the Exchequer, you might have been Leader of the Opposition, but none of those jobs prepare you for being the Prime Minister. Being Prime Minister is so much more difficult, so much more demanding. It's like, you know, going up from, you know, playing for Crowthorne Football Club to playing for Liverpool. I mean, it is such a massive difference in terms of what? The pressure on your day, pressure you don't get any time to really think things through, their constant crises, you are constantly in the spotlight. It is an unimaginably demanding job. And so you have to learn. And the best ones do learn and do adapt. So they're still fundamentally the same people. Rishi Sunak was still fundamentally Rishi Sunak 21 months on when he resigned, but he was, you know, different. He'd mellowed into that job. And so you need to. So you could tell with Liz Truss that that was going to be a car crash because she was unable to listen. She thought other people were stupid and she thought she had the solution. She hadn't quite worked out, well, if the solution was such a good one, how come other people hadn't tried it before? But she hadn't fully worked that one out. And she crashed the country and the economy. And she still thinks that she was put down by what? The Treasury, the Civil Service, the Bank of England, the establishment, you know, whatever. The truth was, you can't do, and you can't get into any job like that. You can't come in, Mr. Dalton come in when he was running Wellington College and saying everyone else was totally stupid and he was going to do it totally his own way and do things. You know, you've got to, you know, to be a politician, you know, the job is there in the title. You've got to be political. You've got to understand that you've got to persuade people, you've got to carry people with you, you've got to roll the pitch before you start doing things. And that's what, you know, whether you're running your house, I don't know what you guys want to go on and do in your final year at Wellington, but, you know, head of school, whatever, or you know, head of this or head of that. You know, you've got to work it out. You can't just work out how you're going to do it, not just what you want to do, but how are you going to make it happen? And that's what you've got to do if you're Prime Minister.
Mm. I think one of the really interesting points you brought up there was to do with you have to be able to learn on the job, you have to mellow into the role, things like that. Yeah. However, there's also this, as we saw with Rishi, things like that, there's a growing culture of people getting pressured out of roles because they're not being given time to grow into them. When do you think that cutoff period is in terms of how long you should have to grow in and actually the difference between that and being incapable of the role?
So all those top nine prime ministers were all in office for more than 5 years, and the great majority were in office for more than 8 years. It takes time to make a difference. I mean, Thatcher was great prime minister, was 11 and a half years. Churchill in the two separate spans was 10 years. Lloyd George before him was 6 from 1916 to 22. So, you know, over 6, you need time to make a difference. You can then start, you start deteriorating. You can see that in some people if they're around too long. It's probably quite useful that after FD Roosevelt, the amendment to the Constitution came in and no president could serve more than 2 terms, because you no longer have the vigour or the freshness or the ideas. And, you know, there is a period of life in any job. Football, England football manager Gareth Southgate, maybe Steve Borthwick with England rugby, where you are just no longer as good as you used to be.
Yeah.
So, and once you are in the job, renewing yourself is key. A lot of people just don't want to do that. They can't be bothered or don't know how to do it. And you have to constantly renew and refresh, which means if you go flat out and get, you know, burnout, then that's not really going to help.
Mm.
So you've got to be thinking about it. And I'm just about to interview Andrew Strauss, former captain of England cricket. He was a brilliant leader. He was very good at renewing himself. And he knew when to leave the stage.
Yeah. That seems like that's a great key point, actually. They know when to leave the stage. They know when their time is up, where they're past their prime.
Yeah, but all of them since 1945 have left in tears.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't always see their tears like you did with Thatcher, but they're all in tears with, you know, their friends and partners, wives, husbands afterwards. Everyone had to leave either because they pushed out, failed at a general election, or ill health, and including Harold Wilson in 1976, so who was drinking a great deal and was only 60. I mean, you know, wow. He made his best joke when he left. He said, I'm leaving. People said, why are you leaving? He said, I'm leaving to make way for an older man. And that was someone called Jim Callaghan. So you have to know, a good leader will know in any area when to go.
Mm. Yeah, look, that's a huge point in terms of leadership and what defines that good leader. But I think another huge topic in that bracket must also be their application and how they can respond to situations, not just in the United Kingdom, but on the world stage as well. In a situation that's currently happening as we speak is the huge controversy around the Strait of Hormuz. Now, for anyone who isn't aware of what that is, it's basically a key route for 80% of global oil to travel through, and a disruption of it obviously therefore causes humongous economic upset. It causes huge, huge issues. And as it's next to Iran, there's huge conflict involved, with Iran saying that they would block the Strait of Hormuz, Trump being incredibly aggressive about his approach to preventing Iran from doing such. And this is creating basically massive headlines right now. So on this topic now, into what we're talking about with what makes a good leader, and Starmer in particular, do you think that Starmer's reacted well to the situation in Iran in general, and particularly though on those transport routes being hugely tied to economic prosperity? Do you think that we're becoming too reliant on those transport routes? How do you think that he can react here?
So, great question again. And there's an old saying that he who commands the seas will command the world. And if you look at the world, there are five key choke points on seaways. And sea is always going to be very important, because you can't carry heavy bulk and it's too slow by road. So sea is always going to be key. And Trump has made it his job to try and get control over three of them. Now, one is the North Passage over the top of the world by trying to take control of Greenland. Secondly is the Atlantic Pacific Gateway, which is the Panama Canal, which he has tried to wrest control of from Canada. And the third is to ensure that the shipping lane here, Hormuz, is open. Now, he didn't get the timing right for Hormuz. It might well probably was precipitated by deflecting his attention from the trouble he was under with the Epstein tapes and or some domestic pressure. It was a perverse thing to do for him, because it's not popular overall in the US. He's got these key congressional midterms coming up in November 26th, and they're going to be really decisive for his last 2 years in office if he survives that long. So what was going on there, and what could Starmer do? Starmer probably did the right thing, but didn't gain confidence by doing it. So Blair went in 2001, he went in with America into Afghanistan, probably the right thing to do, though not subsequently. Iraq, 2003, the wrong thing to do. Labour Prime Minister, well, it was Labour Prime Ministers in the 1960s when Johnson Kennedy's successor was president and wanted Britain to come into the Vietnam War, and the Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, refused. And now Starmer is not doing what Trump wants. Again, it's right, but he just didn't do it impressively. He didn't state, I didn't lay out the case. So he didn't really gain confidence that he was right in doing it, didn't make out a principal case for it. And he gives the impression that he's dithering rather than in command. And people love confident leaders, and he hasn't inspired that confidence. So I would say the right thing, probably, almost certainly, but not in the ideal way.
And how important in your eyes is it to be able to balance maintaining that relationship with Trump? Because if Starmer May comes out as too aggressive, etc., then you can prompt an even bigger reaction from.
Well, that's a bully, isn't it? You know, I mean, yeah. That's what bullies do in your house. If, you know, you're doing what somebody does, or a boss if they're a bully, because you're afraid they're going to make life unpleasant for you. I mean, that's so appalling. And you know, his comment about the FBI director, Robert Mueller, who died the weekend that's just gone by, in late March, and he said, I'm glad he's dead. I mean, look, come on. I mean, this is somebody who fought in Vietnam, twice wounded, and ran the FBI, kept America safe for 12 years, an extraordinary patriot. And this person has never done anything to risk his own skin, saying, I'm glad you've died. I mean, you know, this is an example of a leader who we need periodically to remind us what integrity is and judgment is about. Probably the best thing that can be said about Trump. Didn't answer your question there, Arthur.
I think
just ask
you delivered the... Well, I was asking around how important is it to maintain this relationship with the UK and the US?
Of course it's important.
Of course, yeah.
Of course it's important. But you can't just do it because you're a bully, and otherwise you're weak. Mm-hmm. And the guy who follows, suppose you have a bully who's head of house, so, you know, without the house mistress or house master noticing, and he gets away with it, or she gets away with it, and then they go and you know, the next person's not going to think well of you because you happen to sort of suck up to them by doing what they wanted, you know. I mean, we've got to have our integrity.
Of course.
And integrity always wins out.
Brilliant. Today, we've had the privilege of speaking with Anthony Seldon, whose insights have taken us behind the headlines and into the very heart of political leadership. From examining the traits that define successful leaders to reflecting on the challenges facing modern prime ministers, it's clear that the leadership is far more complex than it appears from the outside. Now, what we've learned is that effective leadership combines personality, experience and circumstance, and understanding it helps us better interpret the decisions that are shaping Britain and the world today. Thanks so much to Sir Anthony Seldon for joining us, and thank you so much for listening to The Oval Office.